like all these ZK roll-up teams, they all sometimes try to act like they're friends, but they're all competitors that have billion-dollar valuations. So they have real money and generational wealth on the line. And then they all try to act like they're really into open source. But if you use their code, like, oh, wait, what are you doing using my code? But like, they're all kind of like copying and pasting each other's things.
Welcome to the Web3 Builders Podcast, joined today by myself, Will, and Evan. How you doing?
You're joined by yourself? Yeah, I feel like this is a SQL table query joke in here somewhere.
You would say something like that. Okay, we got three stories, maybe four if we meander into talking about my problems with YouTube and Google this week. But we're going to talk about the Curve hack and then the hacker returning funds. Tether CEO Paulo Arduino, I always say his name incorrectly, so apologies to him, and his hint at Binance for destabilizing the price of Tether. And then we'll finish up talking about ZK Sync and Polygon throwing fisticuffs.
Popcorn.
A lot of popcorn for us. Okay, I throw it to you for the first one. Tell us about Curve.
Tell us about Curve. Well, Curve got hacked. Viper compiler is supposed to have a reentrancy protection. And in several versions of that compiler, that was not working. And so it got hacked and a crazy amount, I think it's $60 million of Curve. Obviously, it changes by the day, given that like this has affected the price of Curve, has been, you know, it was stolen. And that has led to a big Michael, the founder of Curve, who has borrowed against all of his Curve, right? Because he couldn't sell it. So instead, he managed to get Aave to accept it as collateral. And then he borrowed a bunch of dollars out of it. And that's how he bought these big mansions in Australia that have been all over crypto Twitter. And now he's been, you know, fighting these platforms, these lending platforms, most of which are raising rates on him. Like, you know, as soon as he moves stuff in there, they like somebody, I think it was Abracadabra, went from like 2% to 200% or something, which is pretty crazy because like they, like Aave should have been better about realizing this could be a problem in the future anyway, like their risk parameters. But just in general, like, you know, the fact that they didn't realize and then he moved it in there and then, you know, they jacked it up to 200% interest a year or whatever it is kind of crazy. And at the moment, the Curve hacker has just given some of it back, but not all of it. Because reasons, I don't know, developing.
Some fast facts for you guys who are catching up on this. So it was hacked for $61 million. Michael Egorov had about $168 million of his CRV tokens locked up in DeFi protocols, again, proving that the only benefit of DeFi at the moment is that it's a lending program for whales, a kid, but somewhat true here in this sense, right? Like he had all the CRV that he made back in 2020, and then he took out loans and bought mansions with it, which is pretty great. We saw a lot of DeFi founders out this week talking about like, who's the only true Scotsman out there still in DeFi? So he had lending positions on Aave and Frax and I think one or two other places. He was making OTC deals with the likes of Justin Sun and Jeffrey Wang in order to limit his exposure to CRV, basically selling CRV off-chain to these people so then he would be able to get out of his issue. Notably, like the sales of these assets was below the market price by like 20 cents or so. So I think he sold around 40 cents OTC, but a lot of the Curve on market was going for around 58 cents, I believe, at that time. I'm not sure where it's at as of right now when we're recording, but it's definitely been bouncing around and it's gone down quite a bit since this whole exploit occurred. Then this week, we saw the Curve team escalate the on-chain games by sending a message saying, hey, give us all this back, minus 10%. You can keep a bounty. Otherwise, we're sending the US government after you. And then we saw 10 million of these 60 million be returned so far, including a message from the hacker confirming that the address he was sending the funds back to were correct. So this reminds me of like every hacking situation we've seen. Like the Mango Markets one is probably the most instructive here. where Avi Eisenberg pulled off like a similar stunt. We just kind of knew about him a little bit more because he was tweeting about it the whole time. But this situation seems just like very similar. The only big difference to me is like Michael's position in the middle of it with his huge CRV bags.
Eisenberg is now sitting in a federal penitentiary cell for that hack as well. Do you want to pull up this tweet that has the positions of OTC trades?
Yeah, let me grab it.
So what I think about this is interesting is how many of these folks are considered less than reputable by many people in the space. And they're the people that are bailing Michael out. And I find that interesting in a way that I'm not exactly sure what I'm supposed to say about it. But
yeah,
you know, like why are they all bailing him out? I couldn't tell you. I don't know, whales of crypto Twitter flock together or something.
Well, I suppose like the first thing they probably think is like Curve isn't going to go away, or at least like the token isn't going to go away. And so like might as well scoop in when you can. Other thing I'm thinking about here though is like the initial
Good deal if it doesn't go to zero, right? But if he gets liquidated, then this thing is all getting sold. And path dependency in crypto means that if it all gets sold off and goes to zero, right? Like, I mean, look at Solana. Sequelana is still in the top 10, like just because SPF bid it with FTX customers' money, right? Like deposits. Like path dependence suggests that if this goes to zero, it's going to stay there for a long time. And that seems to be a very strong force in crypto prices.
I also think of just like what happened with Circle USDC a few months ago, where it had a hiccup and went down to like 88 cents. And everyone was looking at it as either like an ARB opportunity or that Circle and USDC was going to zero. But a lot of people are like, no, Circle's like, they have too much money for it to go to zero. Like there's no way it's going to happen. So like I even jumped on that trade and just like bought a few $1,000 of USDC and like turned around and got some profit out of it. And I think these people are probably thinking of it in a similar way, right? Like if you buy a small enough bag, you're at least getting some huge upside from a project that's one of the main pillars of DeFi. I'm sure this will drag out until next week once the hacker decides what to do with all their money. Okay, let's jump over to another stablecoin project, Tether. Tether's price went down by about 10 bips, and this brought Paulo, who's a CTO and the main character on crypto Twitter, out talking about
10 bips as in 0.1% for non-trader speak in there. Will's a journalist.
A very small amount compared to like some of the dips we've seen in stablecoin prices in the past. This shows you how competitive these markets are getting. Still, people care about it a ton. And Paulo came out online and was hinting that this might have something to do with Binance, which right now is launching a new stablecoin on BUSD and Ethereum with a firm that just got some licensing out of Hong Kong. So quote, Paulo said, isn't it interesting that USDT is being pressured down slightly within 10 bips just to push market makers to react? And USDC, the main competitor that you would expect being gaining from the situation, is redeemed heavily nevertheless. While suddenly a competitor born 2 days ago is getting it all. Exactly. It feels definitely organic and not manipulative at all. Some people never learn. So I'll hand it over to you, but everyone took this as a shot at like CZ, and that CZ is manipulating the stablecoin market and attacking Tether.
So many things in here to say. The first thing is how many people started talking in DMs and private chats immediately. Like, what is going on here? Like, why would Paulo tweet this? I think maybe Paulo doesn't appreciate the extent to which he makes people extremely nervous when he tweets like this. And people feel like he has to. And they're worried that, is our money in Tether safe at all? Now, Paulo had recently tweeted about how Tether is over-collateralized. But on the other hand, I feel like they've said some stuff like that before at times when Tether was under-collateralized, and we know that pretty definitively, although they've never been transparent about that. There's the CZ angle. You know, CZ, when SBF started blowing up, you know, lit into him in a private chat that then leaked about, hey, why are you selling all this USDT? You're going to depeg it. And it seemed like CZ was flipping out at the time. Now, maybe that means CZ was flipping out last November. And because of that, because the I guess he has a lot of Tether, because of that, he's now pushing his new thing, which is based in Hong Kong. Nobody really knows, as usual, right? It's the Tether black box, you know? And you can find a variety of opinions out there. One of my smartest friends, who knows a lot of these people, says, yeah, well, Bitfinex is just, I mean, Tether is just paying people redemptions out with Bitfinex customer deposits, just like they always have. But, you know, I don't know, other people, like a lot of the traders will say, no, there's plenty of money there. Like I've dealt with all these people like sending their money into Tether and then redeeming it, and there's never been any issues. Again, the point is like, we really have no idea because it's a big black box and there is relatively little that tells us. So, big shrug emoji.
Big shrug emoji. Yeah, like the launch of the new stablecoin, of course, follows up on what happened with Paxos USD. Paxos was a New York-based entity that had its own stablecoin, Pax stablecoin. I think it had a few different fiat versions of it, but that was like the main undergirding facility for BUSD. And then that was shut down by the US government and one arm of it. I don't know which Alphabet agency did it, but that was shut down. And that led to a lot of pressure on Binance to sort of figure out what they're going to do with their stablecoin. A lot of like inflows to USDC and Tether at that time, of course, because BUSD was having some problems with it not having like a backer in Paxos. And now we have like this new stablecoin regime, which is coming to market. And seemingly with Binance holding so much Tether, they could definitely put some pressure on top of the price of Tether by selling it into this market or converting it. We also saw that on chain with pressure moving into three pool on Curve, where DAI, USDT, and USDC are exchanged. And most of a lot of the DAI and USDC were taken out of the exchange. I believe that three pool filled up with USDT. It was about like 68% of three pool was filled by USDT. So it's interesting to me to like just kind of watch these markets happen on chain, right? Like a CTO or a CEO of one of these big exchanges will tweet about something, and then like a little bit later, you'll just see like all this cash changing hands on chain, and you can just see it in real time, live action. To me, that's like one of the more interesting parts. The other thing I wanted to bring up before we move on to the next subject.
Good for us because it gives us something to talk about.
It is good for us. The thing I wanted to bring up really quickly was just talking about like Tether's position right now in the market seems to be more dominant than ever. They're buying Bitcoin with their profits. They've recorded like $1 billion in profits over the quarter. They have a 60-person team. So a lot of people are looking at this and be like, how are they absolutely just so dominant right now? Like they are the cash vehicle in crypto. The response to that, you have to look at the competitors, and Coinbase announced that they're doing some USDC interest yield on top of that token, which presumably would bring like customers in the door to be interested in purchasing USDC and beat back Tether's advance. Some stuff to watch on that front.
So one interesting thing here is that, you know, Binance has, as you said, Paxos has this BUSD, hasn't always been one-to-one backed. There's like no real news there exactly. The headline is a little bit incomplete. It was not backed on their own chain, right? Because we can't exactly know whether something is backed or not when, like, because we don't know what the custody is. But what we know is that they bridge like the BUSD from Ethereum onto various Binance chains, and the BUSD which was on the Binance chains was not equivalent to the number that was supposed to be because like it was supposed to be bridged. And you know, and Paxo said, well, like we're not responsible for that, like we don't know what but Binance does on their chains. And you know, apparently it was like pretty widely variant. It's sort of unclear to me exactly how they did that. Like the accounting was sloppy at best. I think the person whose report was given to somebody else who is being cited as the author of this report. And I don't think he wants me to say who he is because he works for a different exchange. And yeah, it's just like they just were kind of sort of like creating on Binance chains, you know, willy-nilly, maybe is not exactly correct, but like it wasn't what was in the bridge. That is definitive. And again, big shrug emoji. Like nobody really knows what it means, you know?
Yeah, I guess that's the whole issue with all these stable coins is you don't know what the assets are behind them. Even with the Tether stuff, they've now brought up their case to like attestations because they can't do like the full look through by an accounting firm. But that attestation is what Circle and what all the other stablecoin markets out there use. And they're the ones who like go out and market themselves as being like very compliant. So a lot of smoke and mirrors. Okay.
What does it all mean for you if you're sitting at home and you are interested in crypto? You know, I guess that's like maybe, I don't know exactly who our audience is going to be for this show. But what I would say is you probably shouldn't hold Tether. And I think that's a lot of things that like people that are deep into crypto take for granted is that like basically nobody I know holds Tether voluntarily. So I would suggest that is probably a good thing for you to take away. There is also the history of this space is holding your crypto in custodians and exchanges has been very, very bad. And there's been repeated black swans that really aren't black swans, because an actual black swan, according to the inventor of the concept, is supposed to mean unpredictable. But at this point, if you keep your keys in, you know, an exchange, especially one of the like non-major exchanges, like it's dangerous. So I don't know. I would suggest you probably shouldn't do that. And this space is like there's some murkiness.
If you want any like physical or I guess visual imagery to go alongside with that, Bloomberg just published some photos of Sam Bankman-Fried's empire in his last days, which show Sam in various outfits and in poor state of health, going around to lavish parties on private jets with customer money paying for all of this. So
you used to be a reporter. Who do you think gave Bloomberg all those photos?
That's a good question. I don't see why somebody who worked at FTX wouldn't at this point. I think everyone wants to be part of the conversation, so they would just hand them over.
Do you think it was Caroline, or do you think it was Caroline? Is where I was trying to go with that. So Caroline Ellison is like I would assume she's the one, because it like the pictures make SBF look bad and like a scammer, which of course he is, but like also just dishonest about the whole altruism thing, which of course he was, and like the pictures make a point to like call out the fact that his father spent a lot of time in the offices, and I think that is a very interesting thing. Because SBF just leaked all of Caroline's diaries to the New York Times, which seems like possibly illegal, depending on exactly what the story is there, where they were. But SBF just leaked all these diaries, which actually I think made Caroline sympathetic, like against his attempts. And so I think this is Caroline's way of like, look, you scammer, like if you're going to leak my stuff, I'm going to leak your stuff. And by the way, like your father was intimately involved in this fraud. And so like, if you don't want me to leak more things about your father and mother being involved in this fraud, you should be careful. I don't know. That's my speculation as to what's going on here.
I was talking about it this morning on CoinDesk when I do a show there. For those listening here, and we talked about it a little bit. We've been covering it so much that I'm kind of getting bored of it. But I like that meta take because I think you're correct. I also think it's appreciative of Sam to do that to Caroline. So
I just thought it was funny because she actually is relatively sympathetic in the whole thing. You know, like Sam attempting to say, like getting New York Times to say her cryptocurrency trading firm is total pure BS. It was his firm. Nobody that was intelligent ever thought that she was the CEO or Trabuco was the CEO of Alameda. I mean, it was very clearly like Sam Scam from the start. And I mean, I've been self-deleting my tweets for a decade, but you can go back. I had tweets saying this back then, right? Like to think that they had some Chinese firewall between them, you have to be a complete idiot. I mean, that's why I stayed far, far away from any SBF thing, right? Like when you see somebody committing fraud in certain ways, you have to assume that they're probably committing fraud in more ways than just that way. Yeah.
Bigger than you would have ever thought though. Maybe Sam Truca's on these from his boat going faster over the water. Maybe that's where they're coming from.
Could be. He doesn't have as much of a motive though, right? I mean, he's presumably already narking. Narking is probably not the right word, because you know he's turned state's evidence against SBF, I assume, right? I mean, everybody thinks he has, and he's like, trying to save himself,
not everyone else, right? Like they said to everyone else, like they turned state's witness, like Caroline did, and all the other people involved with it. I'm forgetting their names now. So yeah. I was waiting for the one about Chiruko, but never came.
Yeah, Caroline. I mean, she's an interesting case study because she has written so much out there. And, you know, people have like said, you know, oh, she knew what she was doing is wrong. And like, I think there's like some truth to that. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, she's in this romantic relationship with this guy. But also you have to like put yourself back there. She was like an employee, just like everybody else in this cult of personality. I mean, it was a cult like David Koresh, you know. I'm old, so I go back to Waco and David Koresh. But, you know, I don't know. I think there is a weird dynamic there, which I think people don't appreciate. And when your boss is on stage, you know, and the whole world is saying that he's worth tens of billions of dollars, it's very hard to be like, you know, wait, no, this isn't true. You know, like it's very easy to just like slowly rationalize all of it. When like you weren't the one intimately involved in the fraud, which it seems, you know, relatively clear to me that she wasn't. Not to say she shouldn't have figured out that this was bad. And again, like everybody saw the scams that were going on, you know.
Do you still keep up with SBF stuff? It doesn't tire you out at all? Because I'm kind of just waiting for the Netflix documentary, and just whenever I see a headline, kind of been like, I don't care too much anymore. I'm somewhat past it. And that's probably the wrong attitude, because it matters for a ton of people still who lost a lot of money. But that's just kind of where I'm at with the whole story. It's like, I don't know where I should care anymore.
Yeah, I have some fatigue, but I still find it interesting. It is fascinating to me to continue to think about on some levels. All of the, I mean, you know, big Silicon Valley investor funds who claim to be, you know, so smart, you know, Web 2 traditional firms and Web 3.
The number of people who tweeted that like they would never work with SBF or had never worked with them, but then had Alameda or had FTX in their rounds was notable. Like there was a lot of people who did that. It was like, just take the L, you know, like you didn't know. A lot of people didn't know. Just take the L.
Yeah. I mean, you shouldn't be self-righteous about it if you took SBF's money. And I was critical at the time of people that took his money. Yeah. I do have to say that it was a weird thing, because like that is an area where there aren't a lot of places that you could go. And you know, SBF, given that it was stolen YOLO money, would give you checks. Yeah. And so, you know, there's this weird dynamic of like, if you're in crypto and like SBF won't write you a check, and like it's a negative signal to other investors. So you almost have to take his money so that you can actually like raise the round. There's some weird dynamics there. I know some people that took his money that like weren't necessarily happy about it, but felt like they had to, because partly what I just said, but also just partly because I don't want to say who it is exactly, but they just felt like it was the only way SBF would not, like he was so powerful and had so much money, it was the only way for, you know, him to not make an enemy of him, basically.
Yeah. Interesting from your background in startup land. Okay, let's go to the last story. Let's talk about SPAT, the online fisticuffs between Polygon and ZK Sync. I'll hand it to you for the intro on it.
So Polygon has bought like Polygon was sort of just a not particularly special sidechain. And that's what everyone uses that was Matic. And then they bought all of these ZK rollup teams and are moving in the rollup centric direction. They have a lot of like really good zero knowledge researchers and developers. One of those teams in particular basically came out and criticized ZK Sync because a bunch of their code was copy pasted into ZK Sync, and wrote a really, you know, this is the we have up the graphic from the post. But they basically just, you know, hey, like they're stealing our code. I can't believe this. Look at this copy paste.
Yeah.
The ZK Sync response was, you know, this is less than 5% of our code. It's open source. Sure, like we could have done better on the attribution side. You know, devs aren't always the best at like understanding what open source software licenses happen. You guys have been are building on some of our work, which maybe you didn't fully attribute to us either. All of the other ZK rollup teams, ZK EVM teams have piled on to some degree not. Everybody's got a pine on it. I think the TLDR here is that it's all open source and all basically under, well, a lot of it under relatively permissionless licenses. There are some that don't have permissionless licenses, like I think Starkware. But the ideas, you know, get recycled no matter what. I don't know. Like, I think the TLDR for me is just popcorn. Like, yeah. If you want my honest opinion, and like, I don't have any financial stake in any of these, my honest opinion is it's all a lot to do about nothing. And I don't understand why ZK Sync's investors aren't defending ZK Sync a lot more. If anything, like, I really don't understand it at all. Like, yes, they got some of the attribution, like technically, like a little bit less than they should have. They did copy paste some code, but like it's open source. So like, you know, it's just a matter of like one different line in the header file, which is there anyway. It just doesn't quite say what it's supposed to say. You know, I don't know. Why are you going to this Aragon Akula thing?
I'm jumping the gun on you to
back to this different spice.
No, this is an old headline. This is November of 2022. For those listening, it's from the Defiant. Paradigm accused of copying client code for Rust-based Ethereum client. Aragon to wind down support for Akula. And that's what this story sort of reminded me of. So like we have this back and forth between ZK Sync and Polygon. At the end of the day, in 6 months, no one's going to remember this actually happened. It's better to probably over-attribute that you've used someone's code base than not. Like, I'm not an expert in these things, but you know, if you're using somebody's stuff, there's citations for a reason. And I think like both sides acknowledge that. Alex from ZK Sync even acknowledged that. Like, they could have done a better job at it. He thought it was an overreaction. Okay, so like end of the day, it's open source, whatever. This story was a little bit more interesting going back to the fall where Akula, which was a...
There's a lot of context on this story that I could give, but I'm not sure I want to. Will didn't mention to me that he was going to bring this story up.
I just thought about it while you were talking there. We gotta dive into it. Akula was like an Ethereum client that's supposed to be like super fast. Aragon's also another Ethereum client, also super fast. And then Paradigm came in and built a version of Akula using a lot of like the open source resources that are available from Akula. Akula got super angry and they went on Twitter and had a whole rant about it. Georgios from Paradigm took a lot of flack. It kind of just ended up with no one really using Akula from my understanding. And like a lot of the devs, I think, were kind of like, not blackballed, but just sort of.
So Akula was one dev, let's be clear.
Yeah.
Akula's dev is a good dev, but I don't think he ever really fit into the Ethereum ethos. He didn't, like, people didn't like working with him. And I think that might have even been true within Aragon because he worked by himself on Akula. I tried to get Akula to sync at one point, by the way, when he released an alpha version and couldn't get it to sync. It was never
production
user
ready.
Developer friendly. I mean, like, literally... I think I figured out, I never actually got it to sync, but I think I figured out what the problem was. And it was just like sloppy documentation, basically. That's not entirely his fault. I mean, he was a solo shop, but he was difficult to work with. He often had, and I mean that in like a lot of ways. there was probably some language barriers, some cultural barriers, but I think the main thing was personality barriers. And the thing that Akula or that Aragon got really upset about was that Georgios had come in and asked a lot of questions about how they were doing their client, and maybe hadn't been fully disclosed that, you know, like they were building another client. But again, it is open source, and part of Alexei Akunov, the founder of Aragon, which used to be called TurboGeth, a lot of his motivation was always to get people to use his basic like flat database structure in other clients. So if you're Georgios, it doesn't really seem ridiculous for you to go in and ask questions about it, right? So I wouldn't blame Georgios on that end. And when Alexei announced that he was winding down Akula, I mean, reading between the lines, it sort of sounded like he did say some stuff about, like, you know, he was upset that, you know, Paradigm had bigger resources. They couldn't compete on a Rust client with that. He wished he had been more transparent about, you know, disclosing that they were building a client when they asked him all these questions. But it also sort of sounded like, you know, maybe Georgios had decided that he couldn't work with Akula because he's kind of difficult personality wise. And, you know, also Aragon found it difficult. And so, yeah, you know, the guy was known for spicy takes on everything.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like there is a fine line between like Ethereum. People often say like Ethereum needs better critics. And then, you know, he did have some smart takes, but then sometimes it was just like, you know, I don't know. He wanted to, for example, like massively increase the gas limit, like right away. Right. Which, and like would attack people like sort of like ad hominem style about that, which, you know, if we just did what he wanted, like arguably like the Geth team would just quit. So, you know, like if the Ethereum community decided to do that, you know, I think like Peter would possibly just be like, screw you guys, I'm off, right? Like I don't know. I mean, trying to understand other people's point of views was not necessarily the strong suit here. I've said a lot. Maybe I'm rambling. Maybe people don't care. Maybe this is too far in the weeds. I have no idea.
I'm all this out. So I've already decided. Yeah,
probably.
I mean, I just kind of brought it up because like the difficulty with open source and crypto is that there's always money with crypto, right? Like even in client land, there's money. People don't think of it as something that brings a lot of money. But like Paradigm had money and they had money to go develop this, and they use it as a project, and Georgios pulls a paycheck and all the devs pulled a paycheck. And I don't know what like TurboGeth/Aragon's whole setup was for funding, but like there's tons of public goods that fund these things, right? So then it is money. And I think that's where it comes back to like this dispute with.
You mean the opposite, right? There's tons of like private firms that fund the public goods.
Yeah. Probably saying it backwards. Late Friday. But like I think that the general point here is like there's money in this ecosystem, but money doesn't fit well with open source. And so there's always going to be like these little battles. And so like landing the plane with ZK Sync and Polygon's trying to take like this large market. They have a ZK EVM, they have all the privacy solutions, they purchase a lot of sidechain stuff. They purchased MER, which was, you know, people working on this whole protocol. ZK Sync is doing a similar thing. They're all using a lot of academic literature that's out there and copying and pasting each other to some degree.
Yeah, these guys are all using each other's ideas. I mean, that's the thing, right? Like the lookup tables, like Plonky. Yeah. I mean, they're all remixing and recycling everyone else's ideas in this space. And like, I mean, the idea that ZK Sync hadn't attributed it at all is just wrong. Like they'd said it over and over again that they were using some of these people's work. You know, again, like they didn't get it in some of the specific files that were copy pasted.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, it is interesting, you know, like these people, like all these ZK rollup teams, they all sometimes try to act like they're friends, but they're all competitors that have $1 billion valuations. So they have real money and generational wealth on the line. And then they all try to act like they're really into open source. But if you use their code, like, oh, wait, what are you doing using my code? And like, this is to me just like a flare up, because privately they'll all often say stuff like this too, right? Like, yeah. Oh, well, they're just like, they say all of these people say this about all of their competitors. Like, oh, well, they're just using our thing. You know, like they're just like copy pasting our thing. And yeah. It's like, they're not really that legit.
Yeah.
But like, they're all kind of like copy and pasting each other's things. So
yeah, you said that very well. You said that better than I did. I just like the disputes here. We'll see more of it. Okay, let's finish that. And let's talk about my problems with Web 2 and Web 3. And then let's talk bullish or bearish on markets. This is like, maybe it's just a slight rant, but Evan and I are getting the show going. We're super excited for it, but we've run into some problems. And that is Google.
We can't even launch a podcast about building.
I know. It's like Google is a pain. I can't get the YouTube account going. So if you're listening to this, it's either on Twitter or just the podcast feed, because we're getting black box out of our YouTube for like a certain amount of period of time until like some payment is processed.
And then even subscribe.
Yeah, subscribe once it's up. The Twitter account's even having some problems because Elon, I suppose. Like, I can't get the Twitter password to actually work. Somehow just, I didn't get a password, but I got an account. So I can't really use it because I can't hand it off to anybody. And I guess you want to talk about Web3 interface versus Web2. I don't have much more to add besides I'm just like really annoyed because I'm excited to get this show going and I can't get anything to work correctly. And I also feel like a toddler who has an iPad that I don't fully understand how to use.
I mean, look, everyone, you know, when we're in bear markets in crypto, everyone says, oh, crypto UX is so bad. And yeah, like all these thought leaders get to like rage tweet, like, you know, rage engagement fire, whatever the term is on these days. And I don't know, it annoys me because like my wife lost her main email account, which was like quite painful for me, like a few years ago. And like the company just like, she forgot her password, frankly. I don't know how that happened either, yeah, but she forgot her password. I think she'd had to change it because they'd made her change it. And they just wouldn't give it back. And like, no matter how many things we filled out, like they wouldn't give it back. And these companies will not, like, they hate their users. And they all, you know, if we're talking about Google, it's hilarious because your specific issue we were talking about before the show is you set up a Workspace account. And so if you set up a Workspace account in order to do whatever you want to do, they make you pay them money. But it's been a week or 72 hours of like you giving them money. But if we just used a free account, we wouldn't have had to do any of this crap, which is like just hilarious to Google, right? It's like they make it harder for you to give them money. And if you do give them money, then they like make it a worse user experience for you. And there's a whole, I have a whole another rant about Google and my friends that went to work at Google, and they all think they are so smart. Like instantly, you know, like friends from undergrad, like, you know, at the time we were equals, but they went to work for Google. So like instantly they just thought they were 10x smarter, which nobody thought of them beforehand as being 10x smarter than any of the rest of us. But they managed to convince some recruiter to hire them at Google, and instantly they just thought they were so smart. Like, hey, if you guys are so smart at Google, how come all of your products suck? How come everything gets launched and then killed repeatedly? How come Google search results, the one thing that is in your product portfolio that matters, is worse now than it was 20 years ago when I graduated from college? You guys claim you're so smart and how Google is such a place where everybody works is smart. Everything sucks. Everything you guys sucks. Are not that smart. Where's the evidence?
I brought up Bitcoin's price, and then we'll quickly flip to Ethereum's price. Bitcoin's down like 29K as of Friday afternoon, and Ethereum is at 1800. Us CoinDesk website does not load quickly. Talk about Web 2 problems. It's pretty bad. Bullish or bearish for the week? I think with the ETH, there's a lot of ETF filings, or at least possible filings for Ethereum products this week, which followed on a lot of Bitcoin ETF products being filed a few weeks ago. And that was obviously very bullish for both of those, even if they don't happen in the short term. So I think I'm bullish on both until the beginning of September, because September is always a bad month for everything.
Yeah, we should make it a standard time frame, like 3 months. Like, are you bullish or bearish over the next 3 months? Is that our month?
Okay, then I'm bearish.
A week?
September is always the worst month in crypto. Like, there's, I think, one or two historic trends where it was like years where it was bucked, where the trend was bucked. So I think I'm bearish. It's going to go keep going down. 25K Bitcoin, 1500 ETH by October.
We're definitely at the bottom end of the range that we've been at for the last, I don't know, I'm not a trader, but I mean, we've been in this range for ETH and Bitcoin of high correlation between the two. The market basically treats them the same, which I think is crazy, but it is what it is. And they have ranged, and we're basically at the bottom of that range. You know, I think technicals are sometimes overrated. Yeah. This is like one of those moments where I think there is something to the whole, if the range breaks down, we are probably going lower, and that's probably like a real thing. And like, even a lot of like value investors like me, like, although I don't trade anything like this, I would say is like, we're probably going lower if we break this range. If we define timeframes, I don't know. If it's 3 months, I'm probably, I guess I would say bearish. The whole Binance Tether blow up thing, like, you know, it's very strange. I mean, I don't know. Like, there's a lot of, we don't know how bad all of the hidden and toxic leverage was, and we keep finding out that it was worse than we thought. The fact that CZ flipped out at SBF last November about the Tether DPEG, you know, like, seems strange that now, like, he's sort of trying to, you know, like, Paolo's accusing him of depegging it. Now, I mean, like I said earlier, like, maybe there's some reasons for that. You know, DCG and what happens there is a big thing. There could be other bad situations. The FTX stuff hasn't even sold yet. You know, and if you're something like Solana, where 20% of the supply is sitting in FTX. Like, to me, the most bullish case for Solana is that this stuff could drag on for years, and thus it can't be sold until it gets liquidated. But like, when it does, it seems pretty bad. And I don't know how many years that is, but.
And there's like Genesis DCG stuff going on too. Like, I just saw a headline about that before we hopped on here.
Yeah. All this stuff seems like things that, you know, we just don't know.
Thanks for listening to the Web3 podcast. Give Evan and I a follow on Twitter. Our handles are in the show notes below. There's also links to everything we discussed as well. If you enjoyed the show, we ask that you subscribe to the RSS feed on Apple, Spotify, or elsewhere. We will have a YouTube in the coming days if Google allows us to have one. So give us a follow there. Push us there. Also follow us on Twitter once I can figure out how to get my Twitter password for Web3 Builders to work. Also coming soon. Lastly, please share this with a friend. We're ambitious. We have big goals as content creators. So you got to help us out, even just a little bit.
Oh, I hate the phrase content creator. Can we edit that out?
No, that's going in the front now.
You're killing me.